Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Well, after a several-month hiatus between holidays, the off-season, general lackadaisical attitude towards trying to record a podcast, completely inept technical abilities on multiple occasions, the calendar finally flipped to March, which is what? March is baseball season. We've got the Reds actually playing regular season baseball, I believe, 3 weeks from Thursday. So we've got 23 days until the season actually begins. Spring training's in full force. It's time to get back to the Red Reporter podcast. And so here we are, hopefully getting back to a more regular schedule as the season picks back up again. I'm Wick. I'm your host. Excited about this season. Obviously, we've had an off season that has been one of the more exciting on paper off seasons the Reds have had in quite some time, and that includes last year too. And let's be honest, they made a whole lot of waves in the trade market. The big Dodgers deal with Yasiel Puig and Alex Wood, trading for Sonny Gray, yada yada yada. This year, the Reds really put their money where their mouth was. It's what we watched happen all winter long. Roughly $160 million spending spree, and they've got on paper what appears to be a club that should make 2020. Pretty damn exciting, not just from an on-field perspective, but from an in-the-standings perspective. And that's something we've not had the ability to look forward to in quite some time. So with that in mind, we are getting this thing dusted off and revved back up and kind of looking at where the Reds stand right now and what we can look forward to over the next couple weeks as the regular season rolls on. So join tonight. You can find him at redreporter.com and at fangraphs.com. We've got Tony Wolf. Tony, what's going on, buddy? What are your thoughts on where the Reds are as we roll into a March where we actually have some expectations again for the first time in a while?
Yeah, you know, it's weird. The Reds have a bunch of, a good amount of hype, obviously, when you look at the offseason that they've had compared with the offseason that the rest of the division has had. It's the Reds look like a team that's taken, two or three steps forward while every other team has either spun their tires or taken a couple steps backwards. So, whereas last year we got a little bit of a sign of, okay, they're pushing their chips in a little bit. They're trying to accelerate this rebuild timeline at long last. Now they're, really seem like they should be in the thick of things for the division. It isn't so much a hopeful thing as it was a year ago, I think, as it is, this really looks like a team that should be competitive for the division. I don't know if they are, if they are necessarily the favorites. When you look at the talent that the Cubs still have and Cardinals devil magic and the way that the Brewers continue to sort of remind me of like a National League Rays in terms of just the way that they have such a forward thinking mindset when it comes to a lot of different things when it comes to winning games. I can't sit here and say that the Reds are necessarily the favorites in the division, but they should certainly be competitive. So, you know, it's just a strange thing, you know, when you've cheered for this team for, you know, so many losing seasons up until now, the idea of them winning this year, it's exciting for sure, but also because of how much they've invested in this and the prospects that they've traded away and sort of through that kind of shorten their window a little bit, you don't necessarily have the feeling of how exciting is it going to be that the Reds are competitive again. It's like, well, the Reds damn well better be competitive again. look at how much they've invested in this team. Like, they have to. It's a very weird thing where they haven't won in 7 years at this point, and they really, really better win this year, or else there's going to be a lot of issues there.
Yeah, and I mean, let's be honest here. The Reds have done very, very admirable stuff, not just this offseason, but even dating back to, you know, I mentioned last winter as well, and obviously the trade deadline last year when they went out and picked up Trevor Bauer, who's going to be a big, big part of this year as well. They got this process started early, but that is no guarantee of awesome returns. You got to qualify this. It's an on paper step right now. You look up at last year and where was the big money? Where was everybody else? The Phillies signed Bryce Harper and Andrew McCutchen and didn't really do anything. The Padres swung huge and signed Manny Machado on the heels of the giant Will Myers contract and Eric Hosmer contract, and they didn't do anything either. So, this is certainly an on paper thing, and the Reds certainly have rightfully have expectations on their shoulders because of the moves they've made. But the fact remains, they still have to go out there and begin to actually win baseball games, which is something that I'm still have like fingers, toes, legs, arms, eyes, you name it, crossed because of that. Because you can only do on paper so much before things have to mesh and have to gel. And that's one thing that I'm still waiting to see how it shakes out for these Reds. So, also joining us tonight from the great state of Indiana, we've got Derek Grimes. Grimey, what are your thoughts on where the Reds kind of sit as we sit literally just 3 weeks away from this regular season getting started?
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting to have expectations again. I don't know if that's I don't know if that's the right. Because like you said, it is on paper, but there are some expectations. Like as Tony alluded to, it's not so much, you know, like, oh, like, I hope they're good this year and I hope they're good for a couple of years. And if they're not good this year, maybe they'll be good. No, they need to be good now. There's a lot riding on this season with the contracts that they've doled out. But I will say we should expect them to be competitive game in and game out. Does that mean 95 wins or does it mean 85 wins? I don't really know. But that's a far cry from where they were even last season with, you know, some glimmering signs, or the season before with Wrigglemania and momentum, right?
Wrigglemania.
But you know, like, so, you know, we've been cranking through these red reports the past couple of weeks, and I will say, you know, I do a lot of these each year, and it's, you know, we're what, like 10, 15 players in, and you know, it's a strange thing, because for the most part, other than maybe Freddy Galvis,
there's still a lot of good players left, you know.
And all of the players that I've written about, it's not like I really have to talk myself into it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like writing about Sal Romano as the number three starter, and you're like, well, maybe if you said, you know, like, I mean, we were, like I said, like, other than Galvis, and then, you know, depending on what you think about Wade Miley, like, the rest of the guys that we've posted about so far, like, yeah, like, they just need to go out and do it.
And let's be honest, even Freddy Galvis, like, every team has a worst position player. Everybody does. All the best teams do. If Freddy Galvis is your worst position player, your first worst everyday regular, that's fine. I mean, he's a guy who's an outstanding defensive shortstop who can hit 20 home runs in a season. Like, yeah, he's got flaws. He's got plenty of flaws. But, like, that's roughly a two-win player. And if the Reds get that out of him, the rest of these things should kind of fall into place. And, you know, the one thing that for me specifically I've kind of, like, I guess I don't want to say it's tempering expectations, but it's been a little bit of like trying to rein myself in. I've mentioned multiple times, we're almost 3 weeks away when this airs tomorrow. It'll be roughly 3 weeks away from the regular season. We've not seen a lot of Mike Moustakas. He and his wife are expecting a child, so he's been kind of away from the team for a little bit. Nick Castellanos has been sick and literally got told to go away from the Goodyear because he doesn't want to get everybody else sick. Nick Senzel has yet to take an at-bat or play the field in spring training. Apparently, he's supposed to be back on Thursday, knock on wood. Eugenio Suarez has yet to play. And even Galvis was out for the first 6 or 7 days because of a sore shoulder, too. Jesse Winker got hit on the wrist. Like, that's like 150-ish home runs that you're hoping to have out of this team heading into this season. And we've still not had a chance to see all those guys healthy and together in one spot. And so while we talk about all these improvements on paper, I'm still really, really excited to see how this lineup shakes out, because you've got so many options. You've got so much depth from both sides of the plate once they all finally get in that dugout. And we saw last year in David Bell's first year as the manager of the Reds, perhaps nobody I've seen in a managerial role with the Reds ever has used his entire active roster and lineup with switches and pinch hit opportunities and double switches, you name it. He used as many players every single day as I think I've ever seen a Reds manager do. And it really seems like the Reds front office kind of embraced that concept when they went out and signed a lot of these guys this winter to help build a roster that doesn't just look good and look deep. It looks versatile, too. And that's one thing that I'm really excited to see play out. Once we get Moustakas and Castellanos back and we get Senzel and Suarez as well, I think this does look like a kind of an offense that doesn't just look vastly improved from last year, but looks that you can line it up in, you know, 8, 9, 10 different ways depending on which ballpark you're in, what the weather conditions are like, whether it's a lefty or a righty on the mound, you name it. It's kind of built in to be matchup heavy, and that's something that I think is kind of emblematic of how the Reds front office and managerial roles have changed. It's changed their perspective on things as they've embraced more analytics over the last few years. And you know, specifically, you look up at the two big-name guys they brought in Moustakas and Castellanos, and one thing that jumps off the page specifically at me is Mike Moustakas is not a second baseman, and Nick Castellanos has been one of the worst defenders in baseball for his entire career. The Reds kind of bucked that. They said, yeah, we don't really care. We're going to use shifting. We're going to use team defense. We're going to use the fact that we play in a very small ballpark and try to hide those things to be able to let their offensive aspects of it play through. And all of this, as you kind of dig back through the moves that they made this winter, it just reveals more and more that they're looking at so many different numbers and metrics than they have been even 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago. And so while I'm as excited as can be to see these good baseball players get a chance to play in Reds jerseys, I'm excited to see how that entire thought process and planning gets a chance to play out, because it seems like they've done so much more of the preemptive, you know, number crunching on the front end than they ever have this winter. Tony, you're our resident stats guy here. What are your thoughts on how you've seen them kind of mix and match guys that didn't look like, you know, quote unquote natural fits? But the more you kind of break it down, it kind of makes a little bit more sense.
Well, yeah, you know, I wrote a couple months back, I guess now when MLB unveiled their or I guess there's Baseball Savant, technically the StatCast arm of MLB Advanced Media, unveiled their new infielder outs above average metric, and found that while Fangraphs and Baseball Prospectus it's an oxymoron, but some of the more traditional advanced defensive stats like defensive runs saved had Freddie Galvis as sort of a you know, average to, you know, just somewhere in that range defender. Baseball Savant's infielder outs above average metric had him as one of the best defensive shortstops in baseball. Like, he was literally even with Jose Iglesias, who we all loved for his defense, and was pretty much in the same range as, like, guys like Francisco Lindor. Like, he was right there with, and MLB Advanced Media, because of the technology that they have at their disposal, they can use things like tracking and more more specific details that other metrics just don't have, and you go into something like that knowing that it's not going to be perfect. You know there's going to be flaws with each defensive stat, but with the tracking data that they have, you expect that to be fairly accurate, and the very smart people who are behind those things, like Tom Tango, Mike Petriello, you know, some of the smartest baseball minds that there are, they've organized this in a way that is going to be very instructive as to who is playing their position the best. And Freddie Galvis played defensive shortstop with some of the best of them in baseball last year. So when you look at the Reds going into this offseason and the fact that they didn't buy in on Didi Gregorius, we think of Didi Gregorius as one of the best, one of the better defensive shortstops in baseball. This infielder outs above average metric had him as one of the worst. They didn't overpay to, if there is such a thing as overpaying for a guy like Francisco Lindor or Corey Seager, they didn't, I guess maybe panic is the word, and say we have to go make a big splash at shortstop. They're fine with Freddie Galvis because I think in their minds they think that Freddie Galvis may be something close to an elite defender at shortstop. He's been there even by traditional stats in the past. And as you alluded to, if he's hitting 20 homers every year, even if he's only walking 4% of the time, there's something there. That's maybe a 2-win player. Mike Moustakas last year was another case in which the Reds might have seen something that Baseball Savant and MLB Advanced Media saw Mike Moustakas, where the further into the middle slash further to the right side of the infield Mike Moustakas played, the better he was. Mike Moustakas last year was not a very good defensive third baseman, but where in those traditional third base zones. But when you looked at how much the Brewers shifted along with the 40 games, give or take, that he actually played second base, he was pretty good in the middle, in that middle of the infield. So you look at things like that, and it's very encouraging to see the Reds, maybe either at or ahead of the curve, seemingly on some of these things. Whereas in so many years past, they've seemed to be behind the curve. And with guys like Kyle Bodhi and the pitching development system now, and heading that up from Driveline Baseball, it seems like this organization has come around to the times that they need to in order to be a successful team and be a very, very smart front office and have a very smart player development system going into the future.
Yeah, I think as you were kind of walking us through that, what really jumped into my mind is the way that not just that advanced metrics and advanced analytics, statistics, and defensive measurement has improved significantly and become a little bit maybe more straightforward to understand. You mentioned pitching, and it's remarkable to me when I start kind of walking myself back into how the Reds have put this all together. Mike Moustakas can be an untraditional second baseman because shifting kind of takes away the traditional ground you have to cover between the first baseman and shortstop up the middle so many times. The same can be said for moving a third baseman significantly further over on the diamond to kind of help play that. Much in the way that catching statistics and catching valuations became so much more important to value with pitch framing and the advent of pitch framing statistics, defensive shifting is almost the same as pitch framing. It really is. The catcher is trying to make sure that if the batter takes a pitch, it might get called a strike. But framing the defense is effectively saying, we want this pitcher to throw this pitch at this exact spot, and if he does, the ball is going to get hit right where these defenders are. And so defensive placement is kind of almost the same for the outfield and infielders, the way that pitch framing is for catchers. And obviously, what does that all depend on? It depends on a pitching staff that can actually hit their spots when they're throwing. And what the Reds have done, and kind of the underlying aspect of all of this, is put together a pitching staff that, for my money, probably looks to be the best pitching staff they've put together in maybe my lifetime. And that includes the 2012-2013 seasons where they had Johnny Cueto at his peak, Matt Latos at his peak, Bronson Arroyo flipping up frisbees left and right. This pitching staff that they've cobbled together, and not just the starters. You know, the bullpen has got a tremendous number of talented arms in there as well. You talk about Derek Johnson and Calabody being around as well. It almost seems that the Reds were willing to not punt on defense, but to take the pressure off the defense because they knew they had pitchers that were going to help the defense as much as they possibly could by hitting their spots and forcing teams to hit balls where the Reds are going to have their guys put out there to play. And so it's going to be interesting to see how much of that really plays out because, you know, you talk about Sonny Gray, Trevor Bauer, Castillo, Anthony DeSclafani, Wade Miley, Tyler Miley behind him. That's a depth of really, really talented arms that I think the Reds have put together. And it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays together once they all get a chance to get out there on the field and kind of do their thing.
Yeah,
I mean, what are your thoughts, man? What are you thinking?
To go back to the defense thing for a second, I guess this is more of a – I don't know. I guess it was probably more of an old school way of thinking about it. But it's also – I guess it's also worth, you know, thinking about, like, you see that they've cobbled together some guys that on paper might seem to be either bad or either poor to actually bad on defense. But I mean, you got to remember they play 81 games and one of the smallest outfields in the league, right? So like when it comes to Jesse Winker and Nick Castellanos trying to figure out the corners out there, I mean, it's not like we're playing in Coors or, you know, some of the other like NL West, you know, cavernous Petco or whatever. I mean, we're not asking. I mean, getting them in position is obviously one thing, but the other part of that is like we're not asking them to do a lot. And the other thing that kind of came to mind was, and I don't know if this will actually ever come to fruition, but when we talk about at least the outfield, I mean, Mike Moustakas is probably is who he is at this point, and I think infield shifting does a lot, you know, more for a second baseman than it might. I mean, getting the guys in the right position in the outfield is definitely important, but, you know, getting to ground balls that you might not otherwise get to by a second baseman, like that makes a lot of sense to me. But with like Jesse Winker and Nick Castellanos, I mean, we're not talking about guys that are 32, 33 years old. I mean, there's a small chance that either one of them, I mean, they're both in their mid to late 20s. Like there's a decent, or not a decent chance, but there's a chance these guys can get better at their defensive positions yet. I mean, they're not on the downswing athletically.
Right.
You know, I don't expect, you know, Jesse Winker to he's not the most, and I say this relative to the rest of Major League Baseball, but he's not the most gifted athlete in the world. He's not exactly what you would call fleet of foot. I don't expect him to be Billy Hamilton. I mean, he can do better. He's not like on the downs. Like we talk about, you know, Shogo Akiyama coming in, and I think everybody's already just put him in center field every day, I mean, if not every day, because, you know, you got to figure out the Nixon Zell thing. But there actually is some questions on whether or not he's going to continue to play center field every day for maybe not this year, but the next 3 years of that contract, because he is a little bit older. But these other guys, I mean, they could get better. You know, they don't have to be bad, I guess. there's nothing in their age curve quite yet. We go back to the Joey Votto shirt, I think, from last spring training or the spring training before, about the age decline or whatever it was. Those two guys aren't there yet. So, I mean, there's a potential for them to get better, I guess.
And you know, obviously in Great American Ballpark, if in between that and the advent of the streamlined baseball that everything turns into a home run with, if you just tell them to stand on the damn edge of the warning track and just nothing is going over their head that's not a home run, that's probably fine, honestly. You know, you put deep outfielders out there, you play shifts on the infield, it's a home run or it's a ground ball, and nothing gets over their head and dinks around for an extra base, that's probably fine. You know, that's honestly probably fine, especially in Great American Ballpark. And I'm fascinated to see big caveat on that. I'm fascinated to see which baseball Major League Baseball actually chooses to play with this year, since there's been no real confirmation for Rob Manfred or anybody that it's going to be the same as it was last year, or if it's going to be the same as it was 3 years ago. But That said, I think the fact that the Reds have chosen to go offensive heavy certainly seems to kind of mesh with the way that the trend in Major League Baseball has gone over the last few years. And knock on wood, that's going to be something that's going to benefit this offense. And you pair that with this pitching staff, and that's a pretty good thing to look forward to. I guess transition just a little bit. We have had some spring training games to be able to watch. And fortunately, between the Reds broadcast on Fox Sports Ohio and some of the games they played against their peers, there have been a decent number of games on TV. I don't know how much you guys have had a chance to watch. I've had a chance to watch a couple innings of several games so far. But I guess just your thoughts overall on what you've seen so far in spring training, what stood out as a good, as a bad, as a different, and just kind of roll from there. Grimey, how about you go first, man?
In person. So when it comes, you know, then you come to like looking at box scores and spring training, and not a lot of that makes a lot of difference. But in the little bit that I have, well, I mean, obviously we've talked about on Red Reporter, we've talked about Jose Garcia. That's the one that stands out, and I'm sure we'll get to that a little bit more in a minute. Just looking at the numbers, Aristides Aquino has been struggling, we'll put it that way.
He's been September Aquino, unfortunately. Yeah,
if he continues to play this poorly, it helps the Reds make some of their what should have been harder decisions. But the little bit I saw of Lucas Sims, and I know the numbers aren't there, but that one game that I saw that he was in middle of last week, that first inning, he was completely unhittable. They brought him back out for a second inning and things kind of fell apart. But it seems like that stuff might play up a little bit in one inning relief situations. Who else? There was somebody else I was going to mention pitching wise. Robert Stevenson. I watched Robert Stevenson in that game. He was kind of the same way, that one inning that he was in, he had it working. So I'll kind of leave it at that because I haven't watched a ton and the numbers don't really matter. So those are the guys that, from what I've seen, those are the guys that stand out to me.
No, that's an important part of the Reds roster right now, because that's pretty much the one real spot that's not totally on paper defined right now, which is the last few spots in the bullpen. And, you know, Sims and Stevenson and Cody Reed and Sal Romano, all those guys are out of options. And I guess Romano's off the roster right now already because he cleared waivers. But those are a lot of guys who were pretty highly touted arms that were kind of failed starters at this point. And the Sims-Stevenson dynamic's one that I think is pretty interesting as well, because obviously Robert Stevenson went into last year out of options as well. And it's funny how that kind of works in a player's favor, despite the fact that it also is an indication that they've kind of failed over the course of their careers. Because when you're that talented, even though you haven't established yourself, the fact that the Reds can't simply just stash you in AAA anymore, and it can expose you to every other team in baseball that might have the magic three words that turn your stuff into production, it makes a lot of teams very hesitant to just cut bait on guys. And with Stevenson last year, despite his ups and downs as a starter, they finally said, hey, you're going to be a bullpen guy. Use your curveball, use your breaking ball. It's a phenomenal pitch. See what happens. And he had a really good year last year, and I think has firmly moved himself into off the bubble this year. He's going to be in the bullpen to start this year and going to be a key part back there. Sims is kind of in that same spot, as is Cody Reed from the left side. Two guys that both had great prospect pedigrees, but have just not really had either the opportunity or the success or given a long enough rope to really prove themselves. But when they're on, have some of the filthiest stuff on the Red staff. And Sims particularly, that curveball, its spin rate is absolutely elite. When I watched him the other day, he had a wild pitch that allowed a run to score. And it was almost because the pitch just moved too damn much. He's got that kind of stuff. Cody Reed, I think, has that kind of wipeout stuff from the left side as well. And how those two guys managed to kind of put together the next couple weeks really will help define how the rest of that bullpen shakes out, because there are a lot of veteran guys who are not on the roster right now and are in our minor league deals who, in theory, if they're healthy, were more experienced and more dependable when healthy options. But those two guys are two guys that I don't think the Reds want to lose and are really hoping they can put it together as soon as possible, to go ahead and cement that. Tony, what do you think, man?
Yeah, I mean, the Reds bullpen is such an interesting thing to think about going into this season, because it is, you know, when you're looking at this team and kind of searching for weaknesses, the lineup is pretty deep now after the offseason they just had. We talked about how good the starting rotation is. The bullpen is really where you don't see a ton of, like, proven knock-em-down relief talent. You know, Raisel Iglesias is still going to be the closer, but he's had a couple of years that where he didn't really look as dominant as he first did when he came into the big leagues. Amir Garrett's obviously very good. Michael Lorenzen took a huge step forward last year. They've got Pedro Strop in there now, who has been a very successful relief arm for a number of years now. But beyond that, you know, they don't really have the two or three shutdown relievers that some contenders can boast. There are questions in this bullpen, but I find myself really believing in this group because of Derek Johnson and because of the steps forward that this organization has taken with its pitching. You know, you think of, you know, we've talked about Robert Stevenson and how incredible he was last year. I mean, his numbers, I'm surprised every time I look at his numbers, because it seemed like every time I watched him, he just was absolutely filthy and was striking everybody out. And then I go in and see that he had an ERA over 3.5, and I'm like, that doesn't seem possible. Like, he seemed so good. And it's similar with Lucas Sims. You know, Lucas Sims has just such ridiculously high spin rates on his fastball and his breaking stuff that he has really, there seems like there's still so much potential there for a really, really top of the line relief arm. Cody Reed, I'm still very stubborn about believing he can be somebody, because of the fact that he, you know, his stuff has looked so good at times. And, you know, if you're not trying to move him between the rotation and the bullpen and between AAA and the majors and moving him all over the place, we still haven't really seen what Cody Reed looks like when you say you're a left-handed reliever, go out and, you know, throw bullets until you can't anymore. Like, we haven't seen that version of Cody Reed yet, where he knows his role. It's very it's very clearly defined, and he has to just go out and do that. We haven't seen that yet. And
we saw a similar scenario last year. Sorry to interrupt us, but a similar scenario with Amir Garrett last year also, where he finally was be the dominant lefty and throw your breaking pitch because nobody can fucking hit it. Pardon my French. And that's what he did, and it was electric. And Cody Reed's got that same arm talent. You just don't create 6'4 lefties who can throw 97 and also have a slider that just breaks people's ankles. And the Reds have two of them. And very kind of similar career arcs, to be honest. You know, former starters, took a little while to kind of get adjusted, got their heads beaten in when they first started at the big league level. But with Garrett, you saw it begin to take off. And I can just hope Cody Reed stays healthy enough to get that opportunity, because I really do think he's got that same caliber stuff.
Well, even in that same vein, Jose De Leon is in this organization now. You know, you talk about a former top prospect who's battled some injuries, who you know, hasn't really lived up to expectations so far, and is now in his, you know, mid going into late 20s, you know, doesn't really have that prospect status anymore, but has always had just, you know, those one or two really standout tools as a pitcher, where, you know, you watch him and you think, if he can just put it together in a couple of other areas, he could be really special. And you know what, he's been a guy who he's going to be really interesting to watch as spring training unfolds and as he tries to lock down a bullpen role. And Matt Bowman is also another guy we haven't really talked about much, but again, another guy that when I look at his numbers, I can't believe he didn't have like a 1.5 ERA because it seemed right. like every time I watched him, he just like struck out everybody and made them look super silly. I'm pretty sure Matt Bowman has like the most horizontal break on his curveball of like anybody in baseball. He just has like ridiculous stuff, and you look at some of these arms and then you know you look at some of these other teams like Tampa Bay, Milwaukee, Los Angeles, Houston, some of these really smart organizations who have been able to take some of these raw talents, some of these raw arms, and really make them into something incredibly valuable, even if it's not a rotation, you know, a starter who's going to throw 180 innings a year. They make them into, you know, a guy like, you know, Drew Pomeranz or, you know, one of these guys who they tweak a little bit, throw in the bullpen, and now all of a sudden he's striking out 13 batters per nine. You know, you look at some of those organizations and you see that the investments that the Reds have made into their own pitching infrastructure, and I get a little bit hopeful when I see some of the progress and what kind of guys that this organization seems to be targeting. And you know, even if I look at this bullpen before the season and don't see, you know, four or five knockout, you know, ninth inning, eighth inning guys like the Yankees have or something, I still have faith that something good can come together because of how many really exciting and interesting arms this team has and how many smart pitching minds that they employ, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And it's an interesting strategy because it's obvious that the Reds certainly had money that they could have spent this past winter. They could have gone out and thrown money at guys like Drew Pomeranz, who landed a 4-year, what, $30-plus million contract. They could have done that. They spent that money elsewhere. They chose not to invest heavily in the bullpen. Obviously Pedro Strop, they got a big league contract, but just for 1 year. They didn't get multi-year deals for relievers in the way that they have with Jared Hughes and David Hernandez, and even going back to Sean Marshall and guys like that. They seem to have chosen stuff over experience. For those roles heading into this year. And that, once again, to harken back to what we talked about earlier with the change in analytics and the change in the way the front office has done things, that to me is pretty telling. Because, yeah, they got a lot of very unproven guys back there. But the stuff that they have is pretty much better than anybody else they could have signed for big money deals on the free agent market. They just have to make it work. And so that's the one thing I'm watching significantly because, I think they've got the potential to have a very, very good bullpen. It's just going to take a lot of guys kind of finally living up to that talent. And that's the one thing that's going to be the interesting
one last thing
to
on
watch.
The bullpen,
so,
pitching in general, I guess, but just that I want to mention real quick, and I don't want to put like too much stock in it yet just because we haven't actually seen these guys pitch, but you know, they brought in Kyle Bodie and the driveline, you know, stuff and technology and the biometrics and all that kind of stuff. Right. And the more you like kind of start reading stories this off season or, you know, since spring training started, and they talk to the pitchers, Michael Lorenzen, De Leon, Sonny Gray, they've all kind of said the same thing, and it's not they're in the best shape of their lives and all that kind of spring training like nonsense. You know, they say that their arm has never felt this good. Like, not that, you know, I feel great, you know, I'm going to go out there and do my thing. what I'm saying is like it kind of goes back to what we were talking about with analytics or whatever, but it seems like they've got these guys on a regimen that they're coming in February, you know, into February, early March, and they're ready to throw, and they're ready to throw hard, you know, and I don't know, it just, listening to them talk, like the actual pitchers talk about it seems significant to me, but like I said, we need to actually watch it happen first, but it's just, it stood out to me because each guy's kind of said the same thing, like my arm.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't know, like where's this been my whole life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like Sonny Gray walks in and it goes two innings in his first spring training start. Like for years, we watched pitchers go one inning and then 4 days later go two innings and then 4 days later go three innings. Like they built up. Reds pitchers, the starters have been going two innings all of their first starts. Trevor Bauer's already pitched almost 10 innings this spring. And in an interview talking about his potential future, talked about how he wants to pitch every 4 days because he feels better after short rest than he does after the traditional, you know, every fifth day regimen. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's one of those things where it's, you know, Michael Lorenzen said he wanted to touch 103. He wanted to tie a roll to Chapman for fastball velocity because he thought he could get there. And that, all of this stuff is just like,
I don't know, man. Cool. When I look at Michael Lorenzen, I just don't believe that guy can throw hard. You know?
Yeah, I know, right? It just is like, how does he top 90 with those biceps? I have no idea. I agree. It seems like the pitching staff has got confidence in themselves. They're feeling good, but also that they kind of know that things will work themselves out even if they hit a rough batch because they've got so many different ways of breaking down what it is that might not be working at the time that there's no excuses for slumping. And that's kind of cool as well. So I guess, well, we're pushing 40 minutes here. Any last thoughts? I know, Grimey, you mentioned Jose Garcia. If you want to wax poetic on him, he is certainly the one, you know, it's weird. We've entered spring training for so many years with the acknowledgement that the upcoming season was probably going to suck, but the future is going to be bright. We've been rebuilding. This year, we're obviously focusing on 2020 because the Reds look like they should be contenders. Damn it, they're going to be contenders, and they've put their money where their mouth was to make sure they should be. So we haven't focused as much on the future as I think we have in previous Februarys and Marches, but Jose Garcia has been the one prospect in camp that has really turned heads, doing so at a position where, despite the rumors of the offseason, which was, you know, the big Francisco Lindor, will he get moves, and if the Dodgers trade for Lindor, will Seager be available, and Carlos Correa might get traded, and Didi Gregorius, the Reds wanted to sign him back. All of these things came and passed, and Jose Iglesias even got let go, and he signed with the Orioles. Freddie Galvis is on a one-year contract, and the Reds don't really have a whole lot of shortstop depth behind that. What we've seen from 21-year-old Jose Garcia this spring is one of the few aspects where you look at the current roster and you look at the future and say, maybe the Reds are onto something here because the dude has looked just as talented as any prospect I've remembered seeing at age 21 in spring camp. What are your thoughts on Jose Garcia since he is that one kind of really beacon for the future we've seen so far this spring?
Next to Francisco Lindor. I'm looking at it, 15 plate appearances.
Yeah, there you go.
Total bases, three home runs. He's got a 1.650 OPS. I know I said earlier that spring training numbers don't matter, but for that, this is fantastic. You know, we're what? We're the two week and a half into actual games, you know, like, oh yeah, you know what? Let's have fun with it. I don't know how Baseball Reference comes up with their quality of opponent or whatever. Okay, well, it's a 6.7 for Jose Garcia, which comes out to be about double A. But hey, that's where he's probably going to start this year. So if he's going to do that against double A quality opponents, we're on the right track, is all I'm saying. I mean, it's total nonsense. It's fine. I mean, it's fun.
Yeah.
He really he's doing – all he can do is go out there and play well, right? And, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's spring training or what. And it's fun to see. And he apparently has all the defensive chops to go right now. So if his bat comes around, obviously probably not going to be like this all the time. But if his bat comes around, I mean, from a position that is so barren, like if he could actually – he's already in that top 100-ish conversation prospect-wise. Like, if he takes the leap forward this year, that's pretty big.
That's what I was going to get at, is that, you know, you put the rose-colored glasses on and you can get a lot of positives from him. For one, you look at just his surface numbers last year, but then you process that he was playing the Florida State League in Advanced A-Ball, which is an extreme pitcher's league. And he was basically top five across the board in doubles, total bases, OPS, slugging percentage, all of these stats, while also doing it as a 20, 21-year-old flashing a plus glove at shortstop. That's pretty damn special. And it's not like he was a flash in the pan either. Like, the Reds did spend big to get him. You know, they spent roughly $5 million on him to sign him out of Cuba in a year where they were already over the luxury tax because of signing Alfredo Rodriguez as well. Landed this kid, and you know, even if it's just the defense that you see from him, he looks the part of a guy who can be a big league shortstop. But then you see his swing, you see his size, the fact that he's, you know, 6'2", 6'3", pushing 210 pounds, but doesn't look yet, knock on wood, like he's too big to still be a major league shortstop in the coming years. You finally get a chance to see him play in some offensive environments, and suddenly it's like, wow, this guy really could be tantalizing. And, you know, while he's fun to dream on as well, it's not like he's an overlooked prospect. He's going to be a consensus top five prospect in the Reds system by everybody once they get their rankings done. He's already cracked a couple top 100 prospect lists. You know, I think Fangraphs had him at like 82 or 83, which is the highest right now. That's where Jeter Downs was last year, this time last year. And then Jeter Downs got to Tulsa and got in a hitting environment and broke out. And now he's a consensus top 50 prospect. And I think Jose Garcia has that ability and has that trajectory right now as well. And so the Reds didn't spend big to go out and address an upgraded shortstop over Freddy Galvez this year. Maybe they don't need one beyond this year, because maybe, just maybe, they've got one in-house who looks like he could be the next great thing. Tony, what are your thoughts on it, man?
Yeah, you know, if he has one shortcoming, it's the approach. You know, he walked less than 6% of the time last year. He does have a little bit of he has a little bit of swing and miss in him for somebody who walks that little. So that's something that's easy to identify right now and say, okay, that's not the best. That's something that could hamper him going forward. But you can also look.
I'm sorry. Did you say future MVP? Is that what I heard? I'm sorry.
but at the same time, you can also say he's 21, and you know, right. When Eric Longenhagen at Fangraphs was writing up his top 100 prospects just a few weeks ago, he put Jose Garcia number 82, and he said that if Jose Garcia's tools were placed on just some random college shortstop, then he'd be a very famous player, and there would be talk of him being drafted pretty high. So Jose Garcia is very, very advanced for his age in a lot of ways when it comes to his glove. And just his sheer athleticism, I think, is what stands out for a lot of people. And if he pans out, it would mean a lot for an organization that, you know, we've talked about before, has just had so much issue developing position players out of their international signing classes. You know, even though we did just see Alfredo Rodriguez homer in a spring training game a couple of days ago, went opposite field
somehow. Yeah.
Opposite field on a dinger. So anything's possible in spring training. It's where magic happens. But you know, we've seen the Reds, you know, spend big on international signees and have them fall flat, and we've seen them, you know, hand out some of these, you know, $500,000-$600,000 signing bonuses to 16-year-old, you know, sort of toolsy players who also don't pan out. You know, it's been a really long time since we've seen, you know, with, you know, Aristides Aquino, notwithstanding, you know, we'll see how he looks over. You know, what we expect to be close to a full season in the majors this year. Putting him aside, it's been a long time since we've seen the Reds sign somebody in Latin America and have them come over as a hitter and produce for them. So if Jose Garcia he's not going to be in the majors. Obviously, he's still, as we say, he's a couple years away, but if he starts in Double A this year and is really, you know, continues to hit well and shows maybe a little bit more discretion at the plate and continues to show a little bit of power while flashing that glove he has to this point in his career, he's going to start to look the part of a, you know, one of those kind of centerpieces that these organizations look to build around.
Yeah, 100%. And I guess we should not let Tyler Stevenson go under the radar either. Obviously, we've been focusing on Garcia, but Tyler Stevenson had a phenomenal year last year at AA as well, and continued in the Arizona Fall League. And so far in spring camp has looked, again, like one of those, you know, classic cases of a highly drafted catching prospect at a high school that just takes a while to kind of put things together. He's fought through injuries and everything else, but he's still just, what, 22, 23 years old. Probably start the season in AAA, but has also looked the part in spring camp of a big, big cog for the future as well. So it's a two-part story. It's one that's nice that we've got Garcia. We've got Tyler Stevenson. We've got Nick Senzel coming back tomorrow, or Wednesday or Thursday, technically, to be back in the lineup as well. It's fun to still look at the projections for the future of this club while also having the ability to look at the 2020 season and say, damn it, that's going to be a good one too. So, yeah, so it's been a fun couple months of developing towards this 2020 season for the Cincinnati Reds, and I am anxiously looking forward to following a club this year with expectations, and hopefully without having to just lean on dark humor and satire to get through writing articles about this club every single day for 6 or 7 months. So anyway, I guess we're pushing 50 minutes here, so we'll probably go ahead and wrap this. For Derek and for Tony, thank you for joining us again. Look for us again, hopefully in another week or so, as we try to get this back on a regular schedule. You can find us at redreporter.com, on Twitter at redreporter, on Facebook at redreporterfans. We will continue our preseason previews of all the players we expect to have impact on the 2020 roster in our Red Reports, and also just breaking out where this roster looks like it's going as we get closer and closer to the regular season. So, yeah. So, guys, thank you for joining me. And with that, I guess we'll call this a wrap on the first Red Reporter podcast of the 2020 season. How about that?
Sounds good to me.
All right, good stuff, guys. Yep, till next time.